Hello and welcome to the very first episode of the Corridor of Uncertainty podcast. It's going to be something slightly different to what's on the FPL podcast landscape. It's going to be a monthly look at kind of the analytics side of FPL, kind of getting quite deep into the modelling and the nerdy side of FPL. So you're going to have to forgive us when we get deep into the stats and the nerdy conversations. And I'm proud to introduce my co-host. He's probably best known as the Wee Rogue. His real name is Jamie. How are you doing, Jamie?
Hi, Simon. Yep, very good, thanks. Just looking forward to this. Looking forward to the new FPL season starting. But currently, probably like a lot of people, feeling like everything's up in the air at the moment, really. It's just so confusing, so uncertain, so much uncertainty at the moment about this season. Feels like more than normal. So, stressing out about that. But it's fun. There's lots of fun problems to try and solve, I think, for managers this season. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been this unsure of my draft about with 3 days out from a Premier League season. I think the pre-season with the international break in the middle of it has just thrown the biggest spanner in the works in terms of who's going to play. Cool. So you'll have to forgive us, listeners. We are doing our first episode and our first ever podcast for either of us. So we don't have that much of a structure. We're still going to kind of figure it out, but hopefully it's listenable. But to kick us off, Jamie, why don't you give us a brief kind of introduction to kind of what you do, how you got into FPL and kind of into the modeling side for the people who don't know you.
Okay, cool. So for me, I got into FPL, like probably a lot of people, through like work mini leagues. People there introduced me to it, and like I'd always been a football fan, but not really like an obsessive. I don't pretend to have like an excellent understanding of football and stuff. I never played at like a good competitive level, at least when I was younger. So for me, the thing I liked about it was like the mixture of football and it being a game, it being like the strategy game that you could apply skill to. And it didn't take me long at all before I started like having spreadsheet models and stuff, early doors in my first season. I think I was doing stuff like that with these fixture cross tables, and yeah, it was like these like insane looking spreadsheets that I made to start off with. And I just found that fun, and I wanted to beat my friends at work. And so I've been playing for 8 seasons or so now. Like in terms of my record, I'm quite solid. I think 7 of those 8 seasons I've been in the top like 60k, and you know, like knocking around the top 1%. And I had one really good year a couple of years ago, where I got into like top sort of 250-ish, top 300. And apart from that, I'm equally interested in, or maybe more interested in, FPL from the game and like modeling stats strategy perspective as I am in it being something that's adjacent to football. I think a lot of people probably love football so much that they want to do more with football and they want to show people how much they know about football, and so they end up playing FPL and finding that really fun. But for me, FPL actually got me into football more, because it was to my benefit if I actually started watching a bit of football more often, for example, like to try and help me with my FPL team and try to make sure that my models weren't like totally unhinged stuff. So yeah, that's kind of a potted history for me. How about you? What got you into FPL?
I think similar to you and a lot of other people, is the work league was what kind of dragged me into it. Mm-hmm. And then I'd kind of been into football analytics previous to finding out FPL, so was into the real life football analytics. And I think what got me into that was always wanting to know whether leads were actually good or whether we were just getting lucky or unlucky. So
that right, okay, yeah.
That sent me down the path of getting into football analytics, kind of on the team level. Was kind of already into it when expected goals was kind of a new thing and getting discovered, which was, so I kind of saw the evolution of football analytics from shots to XG, and it's funny kind of watching the FPL community do a similar thing without inventing the concepts themselves, obviously. And cool. Then got into the player level stuff, mostly from the kind of recruitment side. So trying to say like which players are good and which aren't, and kind of approaching it from a football perspective. Then got into FPL. So I've done 3 seasons. So I'm a bit newer than you. My first season, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I took a 24-point hit in my first opportunity to get a transfer. Managed to kind of make a bit of a comeback from, I think I was like 1.5 million or something. Finished about 60K, and then last 2 seasons have been pretty good. Now I've actually got some data and some idea of what I'm doing. So I finished about 12K a couple of years ago, and then 15K last year. So powered, I have to say, by a bit of positive variance. The FPL review model keeps me humble.
Well, that helps. That's right. Keeps us in our place, definitely.
Yeah, or you know, drives us feeling indignant at our bad luck.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get into some good chat about measuring skill and trying to parse skill from luck in FPL, because it's just such a juicy topic that everybody loves to discuss in a reasoned and open-minded way on Twitter.
Absolutely, as with every topic. Sure,
as with all these other topics, as with XG, for example. So I'm sure there's a lot of good content in there for that we can get into in future episodes, maybe. That's interesting that you came from like the football analytics side, like let's call it sort of proper analytics, you know, about trying to understand football and talk about football in a, you know, in a sort of like, you know, scientific way, and then from there to get into FPL. I imagine that's probably an uncommon route into FPL. I don't know if I've heard of someone getting into the game in that way before, but it sounds like it's a sort of dream thing for you. Like it sounds, you know, it sounds like a really nice combination of things that you already liked.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of the people in football analytics go and work in professional football, so they find kind of FPL not worth their time. But as someone who's kind of doing football analytics as a hobby, it is a perfect kind of merging of the interests. Yeah.
And it means brilliant.
That now I've got a model. I kind of watch every single player a lot closer than I did before.
Yeah. That's right. You have to be invested in all the you know, the Will Hugheses of the game and everything like that, don't you? You need to keep an eye on absolutely everybody. Cool. And what about like so you sent out a tweet a week or two ago about wanting to start a podcast that was like a zoomed out view of looking at the trends and stats and stuff like that. What were you kind of what were you thinking, what were you getting at, what would you like to do with a pod?
So I think my prime motivation was I enjoy nerding out about FPL, as anyone who's seen my level of Twitter activity can tell. But I think some conversations are need more than 280 characters. And I'm not very good at writing, to be quite blunt. So I thought, why not use an audio medium? I think there's also a bit of a gap in the content. I think there's a few pods that do use stats quite effectively, but I think there's something to be said for not getting caught into the week-to-week kind of quagmire of what's going on in FPL, because you can kind of lose the forest for the trees a little bit. So I think those are the two things I'd really like doing the pod. And then I'll reveal to the listeners, as soon as I sent that tweet, you'd had the same idea. this is very much your baby as well, not just mine. I can't own it from just putting a tweet out. So what did you have when you had the idea as well?
Yeah, really similar. You know, like we talked about, we were laughing about how similar our ideas were, but it was like, for me, I really I love the kind of modeling aspect, you know, like the challenge of doing that, and everyone's that's involved in that, I think, finds it to be a really like engrossing like part of the hobby. And for like trying to get your numbers right, trying to get your model nice and well calibrated and responsive and balanced and able to help you make good decisions. And there's a few people that, you know, have kind of found one another on the Twitter FPL community, and you can have these really good discussions with. And I think that I imagine there's a lot of people who are going through the process of starting to dabble with like a simple model of, you know, like exporting XG stats into spreadsheets and looking at fixture difficulty. And for me, it just kind of felt like this was a big part of the game for me that was not being discussed anywhere. It wasn't really getting much air. And I kind of wanted there to be a podcast where people were talking about that. And then when no such podcast materialized, then it got to the point where I kind of thought, perhaps I should like think about doing it myself. So yeah, it was really serendipitous for you to have sent that tweet. And you know, now we can make our dreams come true. We can just listen back to our own podcast on this, and you know, we'll be really happy about it.
Hopefully, yeah, hopefully the production value goes up
or not
as well. So I guess, yeah, taking kind of that theme, if someone did want to get started with modeling stuff, what's the kind of simplest model you would recommend someone build if they were wanting to get started out in this kind of sphere?
It's a good question. The way like for me, it always comes back to like the rules of FPL. How do you score points? Like, how do you accrue points? You need to, you know, goals, for example, is probably the like the biggest one and the easiest one. I meant to do actually a little look at what proportion of players' points are like appearance points or points from goals and stuff like that. And okay, there's a lot of players that you'd never consider having owning in the game who'll have a really high proportion of points that are just from appearances. But you want to start thinking about in which ways are you rewarded by the FPL points scoring system. So if you're rewarded by goals, then it would be a good idea to sort of have some sort of idea about who was going to score goals at a certain rate. And inevitably we're kind of crashing headfirst into talking about XG here, because that's a really good measure for identifying and stripping out the noise of goals. You know, goals are really infrequent events. The best people in the Premier League score 20 of them in a season. They don't happen very much. And so they can be what you, like you could talk about in stats has been a really noisy indicator. Declan Rice can score 2 goals in one game and not score again for 3 seasons. And, you know, that's what kind of what you mean by the noise. So if you look at the XG, which is a shot-based metric, you know, you described it well on your video with Andy, Let's Talk FPL. It's a weighted shot-based metric. So you're moving kind of like up a an order of magnitude from being like on a goals level to being on a shots level. Shots happen much more often. There's like 10 shots per goal, pretty much. And then XG shows you how many shots someone's getting and how good those shots are. How likely are they to result in goals? So a really simple model might be you could take a player's XG rate, let's say it was their XG per 90 minutes, and apply that to how many minutes you think they'll play in a match, and then multiply that by the number of points that they would expect that they would get according to their position. Different positions score different points in FPL. And then you'd have what we would call an expected value for FPL points resulting from goals. And if you had everyone lined up by how much they cost and how many points you expected them to get from goals, you've got a model. It's, you know, it's not going to be an adequate model probably for too much, because there's lots of other things to take into account, but that might be a really simple model that you could have as like a first pass. How does that sound for you? What's your thoughts on like how to start off modeling? How did you start off with making models for this?
Yeah, that model sounds remarkably similar to the first one I actually built. So what I did is I also kind of added on expected assists. So that for the people who aren't familiar, it's a similar thing to expected goals. They're actually done in two different ways, but I'll stick with the kind of shot-based expected assists. So it's the person who passes, the person who shoots, the expected goals from that shot is what's counted as the expected assist, or to be really specific, the expected goals assisted. So I added those values in as well, and then I didn't have anything to do with bonus or penalties or even fixtures or yellow cards or any of these other ways that kind of FPL points work. And I just sorted it by that expected returns for attackers. Tried to pick them. And then I just tried to pick the best defenses on expected goals against and pick the defenders from the best teams. So that was my kind of first model that I had, and didn't have any of this fancy how to account for fixture difficulty or finishing skill or anything like that, or quantifying clean sheets. And it helps a lot. So I think before, in my first season, there wasn't public expected goals data available. So I was kind of flying blind in the first 12 weeks, knowing that I wanted to know who the kind of high XG players were, but having no idea, and also not watching enough football to find out. So I did the classic thing of a new manager of just jumping on every bandwagon after players have scored some goals. Because, oh, I really want them. And then, oh, I really want them. And I really want them. And then as soon as I got the most basic of models, I was like, no, actually, these are the best like five players. So if I get them,
I had the right ones.
Right. Then they'll be fine for most fixtures, and then the rank just went up the scale. So I think even the most basic of model can be really, really helpful to, I think, cut out the noise is the main thing that I think the model is really helpful. It kind of stops you just seeing every shiny new thing and being a bit of an FPL magpie and just kind of going after every new asset as soon as they score a goal.
Agreed, yeah. And you know what, it's kind of nice to, like, I don't know, it does give you that clarity, doesn't it? Like the XG rates of players, if you get like a decent enough kind of sample of games, are really like quite stable. You know, you can have a pretty decent idea of who are going to be amongst the top XG, you know, people who produce expected goals in the next month or two, after you've got like a few, like, I don't know, you know, handful or a couple of handfuls of games of data in a season. So it is quite nice to sort of provide that clarity and maybe make you less easy to distract with all the noisy events that are going on in the matches of a given game week. Yeah,
although it can lead you to feeling like you're the only idiot sitting there with a model while everyone's kind of jumped on a bandwagon that works. I think two that got me last year was initially Jamie Vardy, and then second of all Bruno Fernandes, and I feel like I just kind of, everyone's like having a party and I'm just on another island watching it.
Yeah, it's a blessing and a curse. And I don't know if I would recommend like making a model to everybody, because you've got to know like when you're the only like sane person in the world, or when you're kind of absolutely blinded by your model, you know, and you're blinkered by it, and you can't see what everyone else can clearly see, because you're down some rabbit hole, and or you know there's a formula wrong in one of your cells or something like that. it takes quite a lot of confidence to know when to stick and when to twist, and like, you know, and that kind of, I think you develop a feel for that as well over time. The models I used when I started were really rubbish compared to the ones that I had used in more recent years, but they still, at the time, they still gave me this feeling of being able to see things clearly that other people couldn't, you know. And I think that helps and it hurts. Like, I mean, Vardy, it's hard for me to talk about Vardy last year as well, because that was just so, it was a lesson. It was a lesson, because I didn't have him the whole time that he was doing well. And you know, for people who kind of don't know what I'm talking about, he had like an absolutely insane finishing streak, and we can talk about finishing skill in more detail later on, but he scored way more goals than he should have scored based on the amount and the quality of shots that he had. And it's not something that he's known to do, at least not at that rate. But because he's like a big household name that everyone who plays FPL knows and loves from that, you know, from the Leicester season, and because of his consistency, people just see the goals, or maybe they just even see the points and start jumping on him, and it becomes this bandwagon, like runaway boulder that's, you know, that's just crushing everything in its path. And if you keep choosing not to jump onto that as the ownership's going up and up and up, and I don't think many people would make that choice. It's probably only people who are really numbers based who like have a good degree of confidence that what he's doing isn't sustainable. Then you're the only ones who kind of miss out. And it was this perfect storm of like this ownership bubble that's just, you know, compounding every week, and the points are compounding, and all these other teams are running away from you in terms of overall rank and in terms of, you know, transfer value for your team and all that sort of stuff. Really hard, like, psychological one to take when you just feel like you're getting all these bad beats in a row layered up in each other. But I did kind of have a reflection in the summer that probably I was a bit naive at some point not to get him sooner, just because of him being like an adequate option and the ownership being so high. Because when you have these situations where you're creating a situation for yourself where the maximum loss is massive by not jumping on him when the ownership is so high, you risk being completely cut adrift from a huge group of people. And it's really nice, you know, ownership is something we can talk about too later on and get into in other pods. But for me, it's about the stakes. And when you have a high ownership player, you have high stakes. If you gamble against that player, the stakes are high. Now, you're correct in thinking that ownership doesn't affect a player's points potential. A player has no, you know, most sensible players will not care about how many people own them on fantasy football, and it certainly shouldn't have any correlation to how well they do, you know, independent of other things. But it does raise the stakes, and to continue betting against Vardy for as long as I did last year, when the stakes were getting higher and higher and higher, might have been a stupid thing.
Interesting, because I would do it all again, exactly the same. I wouldn't change it, because I think there's no free lunch in FPL, right? So I think, I'm trying to think back to it, I think I had Raheem Sterling, which is obviously had the other side of the coin, Salah, and it was either Mane or I think it's Kevin De Bruyne. So I had those three as kind of my three premium midfielders, and I would have had to sacrifice one of them to fit in Jamie Vardy. And I was just kept going. I was like, Vardy's ownership kept going up. I was like, is he going to outscore any of those three players? And I kept coming down and the answer was no. And then obviously he kept doing it. and I think the thing with Jamie Vardy that was really annoying is that his underlying numbers were kind of average, average, average. And his finishing was just taking him to loads and loads of points. And then suddenly his underlying numbers just kind of got better. And then I could see him getting a better and better options. And I went, oh, maybe I have been stupid here.
Yeah, that's for me why it was like the perfect storm, because there wasn't a good reason to have had, apart from if, like, let's say you don't like the ownership gamble. It was a bad move that kept paying off for a lot of people, but then it became a better and better move, not just because of the points you were banking. Like, you got to forget about the points that you banked, because you have no control over that. You just have control over what's going to happen next. Or, you know, you kind of make your decisions with that in mind.
Yeah.
he actually became a better and better option. And I did end up having him. And it was when he stopped playing.
I shipped him out quite quickly for Calvert-Lewin, and that paid off nicely. Yeah. And I think that was the other side of it, is people will stick with an option like Vardy, who's been on a finishing streak for longer than the kind of Stata's would. Which is you do get the other side of the high ownership, that if you keep at it, then they'll stick with the blanking player far longer, and then you can reap the benefit over a number of weeks as well. So it's not
that's true.
It's not purely one sided.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about Bruno?
Well, this is one of my favourite topics.
You love Bruno.
I mean, I don't. I think that's not even from an FPL perspective. I think he's a great player, which is why I don't love him, because he plays for a horrible team. But
okay, right.
But from an FPL perspective, he came in at what, like nine million last season, and we had basically no idea how he was going to do, because we don't have reliable estimates for how to translate the Portuguese league into the Premier League.
I don't know. There might be a couple of people that do.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's in the public sphere, though, to be honest.
No, yeah. No, I'm just thinking about like your Fabio Borges or your Mikel Tocvan. Maybe like they'd be like literally two people who I can think of who might have a good chance of doing a sort of responsible job on that. But yeah, totally agree.
So there's a big unknown. So and he's coming into a pretty insipid attack, to be honest. I think it's easy to forget, given the kind of finishing hot streak against easy fixtures at the end of last year. And then he put up pretty average underlying numbers. So I've got him at like, I'll find the FBref ones rather than the kind of my model adjusted stuff.
Okay.
And I think it's about 0.4 expected goals and assists per 90, which is not that great.
Is it like non-penalty expected goals and assists?
Yeah, that's non-penalties. So if you... I'll just find out where that puts him in kind of the... What kind of company that puts him in the Premier League.
Yeah, it's not going to be too esteemed. I know that like half an expected goal and assist per 90 is seen as a little bit of a barrier to entry for, you know, players that you'd say had a good individual attacking output or like goal involvement output at least.
Yeah, so some players with 1,200 minutes, you've got higher combined expected goal involvement than Bruno Fernandes, includes Luis Musset, Diego Jota, Harvey Barnes, Christian Benteke, David McGoldrick, and Timu Pukki.
Ballers.
Absolute ballers. And he's kind of equal with Callum Wilson and Conor Hourihan and Shane Long.
Yeah, he's good too.
And actually... you'll like this one, Harry Kane. So, yeah, the broken man. So it's not great value for 10.5 million. And then obviously he's got penalties, and he is an outstanding penalty taker and rarely misses. So they're worth a bit more to him than to the average penalty taker.
Yep.
But you're paying for very expensive Luka Milivojevic.
That's right.
And I think you can do a lot more with money by avoiding Bruno Fernandes than you can by kind of ploughing into him based on 14 odd games.
Yeah, I think that's right. He scares me in the way that Vardy scared me last year, because one, he plays for Man United, and Man United assets tend to get overowned by people that play at FPL. Two, the penalties thing is a big, you know, for people that like stats and make models, penalties is a bit of a bugbear. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. So there's all these kind of theories of what drives penalties. And you think, oh, that could make sense. And you kind of go looking at the data and then you go, nope. It doesn't make any difference.
Yeah. So Bruno took 0.3 penalties per 90 in the league, last season over the games he was in. And it wasn't that small a sample of games. So how many games did he end up playing?
He's got 14 starts in the Premier League.
14 starts, okay. Right. Maybe it's not that big, but 0.3 penalties per 90. And Rashford got at least one of those in the league when Bruno was there. So Man U were winning penalties at a rate of above 0.3 per 90. You know, probably about a penalty every three games. Normal teams...
14 in the season, so it'd be 37.
Yeah.
37%.
Right. That's, which is so high. And what do normal teams get? Like,
average, I think,
a little bit more than 1 in 10, maybe 1 in 8 or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, it's like 4.5 to 5 a season, something like that. About
yeah. 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 So that is such a crazy difference in the amount of penalties that you're getting awarded. And they don't show up anywhere in, you know, like... in his stats. It's not like we're saying, oh man, you they're taking so many shots, they're really like piling on the XG, and that's, it's obvious that they, you know, you end up getting awarded more penalties. It wasn't like that. As you say, like, the attack was really quite pedestrian, and then you just get all these penalties lumped on, and they are like quite a noisy thing, and they're quite hard to handle if you're trying to model players and trying to predict returns. Like, knowing who a penalty taker is in when you're making a model is really important. And modeling non-penalty XG and penalty goals, like, you know, having some allowance for penalty goals is probably a pretty smart way of going about it. I'm sure you've got that in your model.
Yeah, exactly. I've got a kind of proportion of penalties I think they will take. And they don't have to add up to one for a team. So,
okay.
Like, Bruno's got one because he's the top penalty taker. So if he's on the pitch, he'll get the penalty. But then I've got Rashford at like 0.25 for the occasional rotation and when Bruno's off the pitch.
Yeah, and you're sort of over allowing almost a little bit for the penalties, you know, which is a fine way to hedge, especially if, man, you keep getting so many. So you might want to, from a modelling perspective, have some view of the rate at which a team is going to be awarded penalties. And you did a little bit of work on that over the summer about looking at what kind of things that we can see in the passage of play that predict penalties being awarded. And like you say, there weren't that many things that would allow you to like distinguish what Man U are doing from what all these other teams are doing, which would justify like predicting that they were going to get so many penalties again this year. So
yeah, I think it came out as like, even when you've kind of accounted for non-penalty XG, so how much and how well teams attack, like touches in the box and fouls won and number of dribbles. So kind of four kind of like logical things that you think would correlate with penalties, and you put them all in, and then it was still only explaining about 20% of the variance in penalties. So
yeah,
that left 80%. Yeah. Just being like a big shrug, which could be other variables, or it could just be the referees they had. It could be big club fires. It could be a bit of randomness. It's really hard to tease out from a pretty small data set.
Yeah. And I've not seen many compelling football stories about why Man U should get so many penalties and so many more than other teams. You know, it's possible to kind of put these arguments together after the fact in retrospect and say, well, this is because of this and that, but I've not seen too much in the way of that, and nothing that would lead me to believe that it was going to be like a big factor that you could predict was going to happen again in the future. You know, a lot of what we're talking about, I guess, is this focus on what you can predict, what it is, like what you can have a reasonable belief about happening again in the future. That's kind of where the models come in, isn't it? Like, it's one thing I realize when I talk to people about fantasy football is I don't really know what's happened in the previous week or 2 weeks ago, or who I captained then, or who's got the most points, or things like that. Like, I kind of, my focus almost all the time is on what's around the next corner and you know, like I don't care so much about the stuff that could be really noisy that we've seen in the past. I care about trying to find the signal, trying to find the stuff that you can use to predict future returns and plan your strategy best around that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, FPL fundamentally is a game of prediction. And so you're trying to find the things that are going to help you make the most accurate predictions in the future. And then whoever does it comes top of the rankings, in essence. So what's happened?
In theory, yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, in reality, even if they'd made those predictions for the wrong reasons, quote unquote, if they're the best predictions, they'll come out top, right?
That's right.
But yeah, like you say, what's happened before is a mixture of randomness. I mean, it's one of the reasons why football is such a great sport is it's a really low scoring game, which means that you can get upsets and things like scoring the first goal really matter. And it makes the game much more exciting to watch as a sport, but it also makes it much, much harder to predict going on compared to, say, I don't know, number of points a player scored in basketball versus goals in football is much more predictable.
Yeah, I think basketball is a good example I like to use because the score in there is so attritional. It's actually very hard to stop teams from scoring on a possession. And, you know, that's it's so different from football. And as you say, that's like probably the reason why it's one of, if not the most beloved sport worldwide, is because you get this unpredictability, you get these fairy tale stories, you know, the cup dramas and all this sort of stuff, and David and Goliath and Wigan winning the FA Cup and all this kind of stuff. Because of the low scoring event like nature of it, and the fact that you can get a little bit of noise, and if you get enough of it going in the right direction, a little bit of variance, then you know you can even get Leicester winning the league. So yeah, definitely makes it fun for people, and that's why so many people like football, and that's great. But for us, this is the sort of stuff that we're trying to filter out, trying to phase it out, and that's why like it's almost a given. Probably when we look at people's production rates, we're looking at non-penalty XG and XA. That's the kind of nice stuff where you expect to see a lot of signal there in the numbers. So there's a pro tip for people if you're starting to get into stats and modelling. We like non-penalty XG.
Yeah, I think that kind of leads a nice segue. I guess we should talk a little bit about the new season, as we're only, at the time of recording, 3 days away, at the time of release, probably a bit closer, depending on what the edit job's like.
Yeah.
So what are kind of three things that you think it would be surprising to your average FPL player that have kind of counterintuitive but come out from your model?
Well, I am very disorganized this summer, which won't be a surprise to any people who feel like they know me quite well. So I don't know if I really have like players on the top of my head in terms of model that would surprise me. I just posted my team strength ratings last night, so that might be like a good thing to talk about, which is I was expecting Leeds to be good, and this, I mean, maybe it's good that this part of the podcast is coming from my mouth and not yours.
I'll get accused of bias, yeah,
because you're like so biased. Yeah I was expecting Leeds to be good, but I'm really surprised at how favorably my model sees them. So for the first time, so for people who don't know, like one of the like modeling things I've been doing over the last year or so is creating team strength ratings, and it's based on having like an idea about the attacking strength of a team and the defensive strength of a team, and then you shove those things together and you can come up with like expectations for how many goals a team is going to score and concede in a certain fixture. And you can use the differences between how the team does versus what you predicted to update your model for next week so that your predictions are closer to the underlying, you know, view of what the real strength of that team is, and so on and so forth every week. And they keep moving with the results. And I did some work over the summer so that I could have this view of the Premier League teams and the Championship teams, like in the same world, all lined up on a continuous scale of ability, so that you could, you know, you didn't have to be in the Premier League to be performing at a Premier League level. You could infer that from the metrics.
Yep.
And it had Leeds going from a below average Championship team at the start of Bielsa taking over, at the start of the 18-19 season.
Yeah, that's right.
And like a meteoric, unbroken ascent. You know, every week sort of confounding the model expectations by being better than it previously thought, to the point where they were performing at an above average level for a Premier League team. Before the end of last season, and you can kind of infer that they were performing at that level for more than, like, for basically since Bielsa took over, because the model took all that time to get them from a place where it thought quite lowly of them to realizing how good they were, and for them to be dragging up the ratings so fast, that really implies that they were performing at a very high level for all that time. It didn't flatten out until sort of turn of the season, maybe even into the new season. And then they kind of had a wee dip. I don't know how that corresponds to your view of the season as a fan. You might remember it well, but the model sees them as having a bit of a dip and then recovering somewhat towards the end. But they finish up as being an above average Premier League team. That kind of standard. And I had a look at all the promoted teams from the last 4 years and how they stacked up against each other. And I really didn't expect them to be better than Wolves 2018, because Wolves were 2018 were a team I was really excited about. They walked the league, or at least it felt that way. And now they've done sensationally well in acquitting themselves in the Premier League. And they were better than Wolves 18. They were quite easily the best promoted team that we've seen in the last 4 years, according to this objective model. And so one thing I think is a surprise to me, and it may surprise a lot of people, is how good Leeds are going to be. Do you want to say anything about Leeds and how good they are?
I just want to echo that. So I think your model is a little bit more advanced than mine. Mine treats the Premier League and Championship as separate worlds, but you can kind of look at historically how the expected goals numbers from the Championship have translated into the next season in the Premier League, and just do kind of a rough conversion based on
scaling. Yeah.
So it's not quite as advanced as yours, but it reaches much the same conclusion. So I think if you just take the info goal numbers for the Championship, their XG numbers go back to the 2014-15 season, and Leeds the best attack since 2014 and the best defence since 2014 of any Championship team going back six seasons. So it's one of those things where you see an FBL like, oh, Salah first up against at home to a promoted team. This promoted team is very much not like the others. And exactly what you're saying, I think the model's experience of Leeds kind of it taking time to realize how good Leeds are is exactly the experience I had as a fan, just being like, oh god, we're really good.
This real.
we're really really good. And we started off the start of the season even better than last year, and that I think after the first six games Adam Forshaw got injured, and then the performance levels cooled off a little bit. We had to change the shape a little bit. And we had a wee dip in the mid-season as well. But again, we ended up walking the league. It didn't feel like that as a fan at the time, but we finished 10 points clear, and we've been the best team of the Championship for 2 years running. So I'm very excited about the season. And I think I often get accused of bias, but then I kind of look at it, it's like, well, I don't change the expected goals models based on my fandom. I just kind of, the numbers go into the model and it spits out what it spits out. So I think my model for the Premier League has us finishing seventh in a kind of tight group from seventh to 12th. So that kind of range.
And me too.
And I think.
Go on.
No, go ahead, Aslan.
I was just going to say one thing that surprised me a bit because I didn't really have a big expectation about what they were like in terms of how their style translated to goals scored and conceded, but I have them as a relatively a bit better in defense than they are in attack. That's what I expect to see in the season ahead. Like in terms of their defense, I've got them joint seventh with Everton and a little bit better than the likes of Sheffield United and Tottenham, which might surprise some people. And their attack is very competent. I've got it around about 10th, somewhere in between Southampton and Everton. Everton are a good comp for Leeds, and where I think that how people should feel about how good they are. Okay, they've gone out and bought a few quite nice high quality midfielders and stuff. But Leeds, I think, are about as good as Everton is how people should be thinking about them. Or that's how I'm going to be thinking about them for the season ahead. So that was definitely something that surprised me a bit from my modelling about the season ahead. How about you? Have
Yeah.
you got any good or anything more to say on that or anything that jumped out of your models for the season ahead?
Not really. I mean, my numbers broadly agree with you as kind of about seventh in defence, about tenth in attack. I'd add a slight caution on Everton. I think, well, Ancelotti is famous for not pushing his players when they don't need to be pushed. The theory being that they'll give him more when they do actually need to be pushed. So Everton's attacking numbers really tailed off towards the end of last season, and I expect there to be some kind of natural pickup when they actually start trying again.
Yes,
I'd probably have Leeds slightly behind Everton, but I think Spurs, more controversially, is probably a fair comparison. But that's me kind of thinking Everton are quite a bit better than Spurs.
Yeah, I think I have Spurs just a little bit better than those guys, but not much, really, really not much. Very much in the rounding. They're in that mix of teams that are probably not good enough to sort of seriously think of themselves as having a good chance at a top four run. More like a Europa League run. So yeah, I just wanted to touch on something you said there about the how we should feel about the end of the season. A lot of people seem to be putting a lot of weight on the matches that happened after the resumption of the pause in the Premier League. The sort of let's call it the post-lockdown matches. Do you have a take on your sort of stats view on how we should be feeling about the treatment of post-lockdown data versus the data that preceded that?
Yeah, so there's kind of two separate parts of the model, one of which is the team strength and one of which is the player strength. So my team strength model works very much as yours does earlier. So you kind of predict what's going to happen in each fixture, and it's a rolling rating that constantly gets updated. So I think that takes into account new data pretty much constantly, and you don't need to worry about is this most recent data weighted correctly, because the model kind of does it for you. So on the team strength ratings, I think you probably want to mentally adjust for when teams got on the beach. So I think, in like I just mentioned with Everton, they were on the beach for the last 9 games, and you can see that their ratings really, really, really dropped off post restart. And so when you see big swings like that, then you probably want to somewhat discount it, and my model weights back towards the season average at the start of each season to kind of take account for that. And then on the player level, I think people are overrating how much stock to put in 9 games. I think
Yeah, I kind of do too.
if you were to say to someone in game week 27, "Hey, you should only look at data from game week 18," they think you're crazy, or they should think you're crazy at least. You don't have enough of a sample from 800, 900 minutes to say that much conclusively. I know FPL Review's written quite extensively on how noisy expected goals as a measure itself is. And so I really wouldn't want to be chucking data in the bin, especially from the same season where there's no shuffle in managers or transfers in that lockdown period like you get at the start of a season that would make you want to reset your baselines.
That's right. That's a theme that we can come back to about like weighting your data for older stuff and putting data in the bin, because we already talked about how sparse the events are in football. Like, we really need all these events to make our samples more robust. And it's kind of, whenever someone shows me something that's like a subset of the available data, I just think sample size. And what I mean by that is that when you have small chunks of data, the noise is much louder than when you have larger samples, and you can start to tune that noise out and you see more signal coming through. So if someone is presenting stats that are like a subset of data, like here's them at home or here's them without someone else on the pitch and stuff like that, or here's only the post-lockdown stuff, I kind of feel
home and away is my favorite one for that.
Yeah, that's right. That's a common one. The thing I want to say is, tell me the footballing reason why I should expect that this thing that's happened in the past is going to happen again. Because I don't want to be, you know, I try to be humble about my knowledge about football, and if and listen to other people who watch more football than I do and who know more about it. If there's a good reason that you can see they do something tactically that happens that kind of explains this, then that means I can say, okay, like, I'll give that a little bit of credence. Like, maybe that could explain some of this difference that we're seeing. But my default feeling is, that's just noise. Like, if you take a small sample of anything, you can just see what you want. Someone will stick out. Someone will stick out at the top. Someone will stick out at the bottom. And there's all these ways of cutting it, and they don't help you to predict what's going to happen in the future, unless there's some like legitimate reason for it. And personally, I don't see why the lockdown conditions would affect individual players in a way that's going to help us to predict what they're going to do next year. I think if you're seeing differences in the post-lockdown data, it's more likely to be noise than it is to be indicative of some, you know, okay, they don't have fans, all of a sudden it turns them into like a really good finisher or something. You know, I just don't see the rationale for that. And so I'm inclined to not to put too much stock in the post-lockdown data. A couple of things we saw, but home advantage seemed to deteriorate a little bit, and there's a really good reason for that, and we saw it in lots of leagues. That's something I expect to be a thing with less fans. Also, goals seem to be suppressed a little bit, and that's something else I can believe, because you don't have fans cheering you on, and people are maybe like, you know, taking fewer shots and not trying to please the crowd in any way. Like, it doesn't form any part of their thinking, whereas before it might have formed a small part of it, or, you know, some willingness to entertain, or just like getting spurred on by your home crowd and stuff like that. Goals seem to be a bit suppressed, so I would expect for this season to see a bit fewer goals and maybe a bit more clean sheets and that kind of thing. But those are like, even those, we don't really have too much data to go on to suggest that they're going to be big factors. But I think I derailed you from talking about some things in 2021 that you were maybe started sticking out in your model.
No, I hadn't really got them, but I think what I find interesting when I'm looking at my model is I sort it by value, and that's another big meaty topic that we can get in into. And there's a lot of players that are not super nailed, but if they were, would be outstanding value.
Yeah.
So your likes of let me just get the top few. I've got Phil Foden, who could be semi-nailed this season. He seems to get more minutes season on season. Alioski at Leeds, he's not going to be nailed at all. Reece James could be a game breaker. Ruben Vinagre looks like he's getting sold. Diogo Jota, another one who is outstanding on the stats, but seems to have sporadic starts. And then one that surprised a few people is Nicolas Otamendi, but I think that's more whistling than anything else.
City defenders always look good in the models, and they get they end up getting subbed on in the 96th minute for a one-pointer, or City tend to something I think is like a legitimate football reason that you might not want City defenders sometimes is that they because of their style, because of how attacking they are, they concede in routes. You know, they win 5-1 and they don't mind winning 5-1. Like, no one in football, this is my kind of theory, no one in football actually cares about clean sheets. You care about scoring more than the opposition, and the way that some teams set up, it's nicer to try and win 1-0. But no one actually cares about a clean sheet. Maybe a goalie does. Except in FBL, we care about them, you know, so much, because this is the way that we're awarded points for defenders to score clean sheets. So being a good team, being a dominant team, and having a good defence are, you know, are somewhat predictive of registering clean sheets, but not completely. And that's something that I feel like I've been burned a bit with on Man City defenders.
Although, saying that, I just had a quick look, and the most clean sheets in the game was Kevin De Bruyne with 18.
Yeah, that was like Salah the year before.
So it seems to almost go the other way. It's like when City concede one, they concede two.
Well, that happened last year a lot. They really struggled when they, in games that they were tight or where they went behind, they really did struggle. I really want to see some evidence of them having some more game control this year, or being able to stay who they are when they're losing, because they seem to change game plan and just go into this like crazy crossing mode where it's just like, you know, David Moyes Man United style, just like death by a thousand crosses and stuff, and it doesn't really make sense to me as a watcher as to why Man City would try that. So yeah, it'd be nice to see them getting a bit more game control this year.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see a bit less rotation, but we don't always get it.
That's not going to happen.
How do you think about those kind of players then? When so at least the way my model's built is that it's built assuming that a player starts 38 games, so it takes into account how long players stay on the pitch and whether they get subbed off when they've started the game. But I haven't modelled how likely players are to start the game. I know FPL Review is taking kind of giant strides. But even then, he says it's the hardest part of the game to model. So how do you think about these kind of players when they could be nailed, and if they are, they're some of the best assets in the game, but you have a lot of uncertainty over them?
Well, I hate these players. They're the players that you stress about massively as a modeler, because we'll bang on about this, but is trying to get the minutes, trying to model minutes, is probably the thing that you spend most time on as a modeler, because you can get the goal rates and everything else like quite easily, and they're quite stable. But trying to model the minutes is like a real dark art, and it's so important because it's the multiplier for all these things. Like if Phil Foden is going to score like 0.4 expected goals per 90 and he plays 75 minutes, that's a massive difference between if he gets a 15 minute cameo. So for me, these guys are like the big stress, and I suppose it could come down to risk appetite. If you've got quite a healthy, high risk appetite, and you're, or maybe you're like a risk-seeking sort of manager, you can game that. But you can pick David Silva when he was there. He was like the classic example I used to use, where if you have a modeling expectation that he's going to average 55 minutes, he's like not value at all. And then you tweak it so it's 65, he's really good value. And then you tweak it so he's 75, and he's easily the best player in the game who's like just breaking everything. That's how sensitive it can be with especially Man City attackers, because their rates of production are so high, their minutes uncertainty is so high. When you get these guys right, or when you get a run of them, that it can be so valuable. Jesus is a really good example from the run-in last year, because people have a bias against him because they think he's not a good finisher, which he might not be. But his shot getting is insane. The rates that he puts up of like shot volume and shot quality are just absolutely nuts. And you can be a really bad finisher and score a lot of points. When he became nailed because Aguero was injured, he really becomes a no-brainer. And like I say this with laughing because I didn't actually have him in my team, but I told some of my friends to get him and they did get him and he did really well for them. But it just didn't work out with my structure for whatever reason with the transfers I was making. But if you can find City guys that start to get nailed all of a sudden, then you just love it. And Foden at 6.5 is one of the players that I expect to own at certain points of season. I've had him in drafts for game week one. David Silva's gone. That means you should be optimistic about Foden getting more minutes. You know, realistically. These players are really hard to model. Maybe it's an advantage not to model if you are thinking about these players. You know, maybe it'll allow you to be a little, like, to see things a little bit more clearly. I don't know. But like you mentioned, a lot of good names. Other names that I've seen this from just like having a look this preseason are like Shea Adams could be a really good option if he gets minutes, but you don't know about his minutes. I think Leandro Trossard, the Brighton midfielder, could be a really good option this year if he gets minutes, but you don't know if he's going to get minutes. How it works out with Pulisic, Havertz and Ziyech is going to be really interesting, as to see like how the minutes get shared. This season I just think is so poised for, like, there's no easy decisions, I don't think, or there's very few easy decisions in for coming up with our game week one teams. The pricing seems to have been done like really effectively, with not many mistakes, maybe no mistakes, no big mistakes. And these guys, like, if they start to play more than we might have expected, there's quite a lot of guys that we'll probably be sitting there with our models watching the minutes in the first three or four game weeks, just like ready to jump on them. So, yeah. Tough.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think I've got Foden at the moment, but I've tried to avoid and Reece James, actually. I couldn't resist that one, but yeah, I think it's a bit of a leak in my game to get kind of caught thinking that, oh, but they'd be so good if they were nailed, and then just kind of hoping more than thinking.
Exactly. Yeah, talking yourself into it. Yep. I think that's right.
So with 3 days out from the season, what is your draft look like? What's your kind of thinking behind it, and how certain is it?
Yeah, I'll speak in sort of broad strokes, because I like the idea of us having like quite a wide angle, zoomed out look at the season, rather getting into too much of the nitty gritty. But the things that I'm thinking about are like around the structure. It seems to me that there's more value in forwards relatively than there has been in previous seasons. So I'm thinking about going with three forwards, which is not something that I often do. How many like super premium guys to take? I think there's an argument that you can get away with one, let's say like 11.5 million plus guy as a structure. I think there are viable structures with that this year, whereas normally you'd automatically say that it's nice to have two, because then you've got, you know, these like rotating captain options. And
I've been set on two basically until earlier this morning, when I just started looking at Pulisic being fit and James Rodriguez and all these kind of wanting all these shiny bits in my midfield, and I was like, I can either sacrifice Trent Alexander-Arnold, or I can go to one premium.
Mm-hmm.
And
that sounds hard.
yeah, exactly. Or not have the shiny things, of course.
Yeah, I mean, there's a case to be made for waiting for James and Pulisic, definitely. My, like, so there's a few things that are like context for me about the 2021 season and how I'm thinking about it and why I think it's going to be so hard. And I've got a wee list here. I'll rattle through it, right? The transfer window is still open. We don't know who teams are going to end up selling, end up buying, how that's going to change the landscape of players.
Yeah.
The fixture schedule is insane. Because we're playing a squash season that's starting late, it's like the games are so densely packed. We don't know how that's going to affect teams. There's a pretty good reason to believe that it's going to affect stronger teams that are playing in Europe and having long cup runs more than it's going to affect weaker teams, which kind of means you level the playing field a little bit between teams in the league. You've got coronavirus and what that means. So you could get like players getting all of a sudden quarantined on short notice, and you know you've got them in your team and all of a sudden you don't. I don't know how much notice we're going to get about that, but the coverage in the English media, British media, I think has been terrible in terms of like finding out who's got coronavirus. A lot of the time when you find out, it's a foreign source and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm worried about that. Postponements could be a thing. I found the rules the other day, and they're really trying to avoid postponements. They're saying as long as you've got 14 players in your squad, and that can include, I think, some youth players, then you're not allowed to request a postponement, or if you do, it won't happen. So I think postponements probably aren't going to happen very much.
Because the schedule is so tight already that they don't really have
exactly. They kind of can't afford to do it, and I don't really think that they're going to mind about the safety aspect as much as they mind about their sponsors and getting their games finished and all that sort of stuff, their contracts and everything. There's still no fans, so we don't know what that means for home field advantage, goals per game. We saw evidence that both those things were subdued in lockdown, and we don't know when they're going to start being fans. And another like huge thing, which I don't know how common knowledge it is, but there is reason to believe that this year, the way that the PGMOL and the referees in the English Premier League adopt the VAR rules, specifically around handball and penalties, is going to be much more in line with what FIFA intends. Because I think FIFA is like taking over the way that VAR is enforced in all leagues now. And that means, like, for people who don't know, at the start of last year, betting markets were going crazy on how many penalties there was going to be in England, and everyone thought there was going to be so much more. And it's not just because of VAR, it's because of the new handball rule that came in last year, which is like, you know, they're much more strict around if it hits your hand at any point and doesn't have to be remotely intentional or even have to make a different silhouette and stuff like that. There was going to be so many more penalties, and it didn't happen. And the reason is because the English PGMOL, the Refs Association, just chose to treat it differently. And now they think they might not be able to treat it differently. And that could be massive for us in terms of how highly we value penalty takers. And we've already spoken about how much of a pain in the ass it is to try and model penalty takers correctly. But the betting markets are pretty high on penalties this year. I think they think there's going to be somewhere in the region of like 20 to 30% more penalties than there was last year. Jeez. So there's a minefield of stuff that is going to happen in we're dealing with in 2021. And that's kind of like things that I'm taking into account when I'm thinking about my squad. Strategically as well, maybe this is a good thing for you to talk about if you want, is what to like early wild card thoughts, because we've got these blanks and doubles in 18 and 19 that we know about. Do you have any plans around that?
Yeah, I think for me that completely rules out the early wild card. I think there's such a big advantage to holding your wild card through to 16. I kind of think it's analogous to when we get our second wild card and we never use it early because we know we're going to need it for the doubles and the blanks. And this time round, we have two lots of doubles and blanks, and we have two wild cards over the season. And so it makes sense in my head to go, well, I need the first wild card for the first round of doubles and blanks. I need the second wild card for the second round of doubles and blanks. So therefore, I'm happy to take the odd hit if I really need to. I'm not a big fan of hits in general, but I would rather, if I'm in a really tight spot, take a hit than use a wild card. So again, I'm trying to minimize future transfers and I can't resist like looking at the value, but at the same time, I'm trying to pick safer options. But then if they turn out to be really good value, I'm going to want to jump on them. So I kind of go around in circles on it.
That's right. I think it's just really hard. Like, there's no gimmies. There's no minimum price player, I don't think, in the game that looks like a good option.
Yeah, I agree with that. Potentially, you know, Brewster.
There's no 4.5.
If he gets a move.
If Brewster goes, that would be the only gimme, pretty much. There's really no £4 million defenders, I don't think, that are like. There's certainly no Lindstroms, and there's not even any Wan-Bissakas. Mitchell and Johnston are the ones people are talking about. I can't get excited too much about them.
No,
and
neither.
All those reasons that we had before make me want to prioritize actually having a playing bench. So like my structure is looking really different to how it normally would in other seasons. And I think there's like decent justification for having a different approach and a different structure this year to try and be more robust and more bulletproof. And like the idea of trying to get through 16 game weeks with like no preseason, like no friendlies. We don't know even what the lineups are for these teams. We don't, you know, there's very few gimmies. Even Vinagre, he was a kind of a gimme, and now he's not. So it's just like really hard, and it's exciting for me because it means it should respond to skill quite a lot more, like future planning and stuff. But those, like at the moment, I really don't know who's going to be in my team, but I'll probably have, I might have 15 playing players in my squad. I might have two keepers and everything as it stands, just because I suppose I stress out a bit about the like what could go wrong and stuff like that. So definitely some different like strategic things to take into account this year. That I don't know, they might catch some people on the hop if they're not aware of them already. How set are you on your draft and stuff? Yeah, you go.
I'm reasonably set. I mean, if the listeners want to go and have a look, they can go and have a look on my Twitter. It's pretty much the same as the last one I posted, only with Sice instead of Vinagre. I agree with you. I think I probably will have a lot of playing players. At the same time, I think I'm not too worried about getting it slightly wrong at the start. So if I think by game week 4, I could have changed 20% of this team without taking any point sets. So if you make a couple of mistakes, you can rectify them pretty quickly. And I'm probably going to be avoiding jumping on the early bandwagons based on a tiny sample. So I'll be looking for things like minutes for players that I already think are good. And if I find a couple of players that are playing more than I thought they would, or less than I thought I would, that's where I want to make the moves in the first few weeks. And so because I won't have that much of a sample on the new season, taking a few kind of corrective moves in the first few weeks is often a good way to stop you screwing up your team early, which I've done pretty much every season I've played FPL, because I've got caught on the new shiny thing, as is my one. So in a way, getting it wrong could almost be a blessing in disguise, I think.
Yeah, it's. I'm totally with you on that. I think transfers are going to be really precious at the start of the season. That's the way that I'm treating it, and I'm the same. I'm trying to pick some guys that I'm going to be happy enough to hold, and I don't expect many luxury transfers, and I don't really want to waste any running around on some. Some player, some Theo Walcott or something like that. That's something that I'm thinking about quite a lot, is like more than normal, is how to be pragmatic with my structure. How much do you think about structure of your squad? Because I am not going to lie, I, as a modeler, I tend to put the players in the model and find out which ones are like outlying value and shove them all in the squad and then play. But I can see why that is like a bit inflexible, because if you get it wrong on one of those guys and there's no one else near that price, and you know, you can kind of get like a wee bit, paint yourself into a corner. So I'm trying to be more pragmatic about the way I think about my squad structure, and if there's two decent options, I might pick the more flexible one. How do you think about structure much when you're making a squad?
Yeah, I think it's pretty marginal. So I've thought about it in this draft only to the point where I have Aubameyang with the view to turning him into Sterling in game week 3, because I think the fixtures swing for Arsenal. I think he's the best captain in the first 2 weeks.
Yeah, and then, agreed.
And then Sterling, I think, is a great asset. You could also have KDB if it's your personal preference. Yeah. So I've wanted that kind of second 12 million spot, because I think Salah is a standout captain, I think 4 weeks out of 5, from 3 to 7 on my model. So I'd like to kind of keep him and Sterling as the two premiums. But beyond that, I don't think about it too much. So in a lot of my early drafts, I had Vardy and Son with the idea that I would downgrade Vardy and upgrade Son. So all you end up doing is you end up using one extra transfer to kind of retool your structure.
So yes.
It's relatively easy in FPL to go from two mid-ish price players to a real premium and a 6-7 million player in two moves rather than one. So you have the potential cost of one extra transfer if you want to switch the structure, but it's probably not worth making your team worse in order to do it.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think one area that it comes into play for me is how much to spend in defence, because I don't know about you, but I think people that look at the numbers and model a lot tend to actually have a preference for the value that you can find in defenders relative to your average player who like plays the 3-4-3 every week. There is really good value in defence, like the extra bang for your buck that you get for spending an extra half or an extra one can be quite a lot. But structurally, strategically, if you spend that money and like spread it out quite thin over like all 4 or 5 defenders, that could be a structure, I think, that's hard to free transfer your way out of. That's the kind of thing I'm like maybe a little bit wary of, but totally agree. Like this year, I'm probably going to start with Oba and Salah, and then I've got designs on turning Oba into Sterling or KDB or like Rashford, and doing something else with that extra money that I get. You know, upgrading one of my forwards or something like that. And those kind of moves are easy enough to make. You know, I'll look to have 2 free transfers for game week 3 and think about a mini wild card or think about how things are looking then.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point on the defenders. I think there's a lot of value in the kind of 5 and tier over the 4.5s.
Yeah.
Depending on how many 4.5s you want to have. But I think you've kind of got your basic template's got Trent, and then you've got some cheaper defenders, and I think it's worth having a couple of 5.0s rather than a 4.5 and taking one million total out of your attack, which shouldn't ruin your flexibility too much. I tend to be quite an advocate of 3 at the back, because your clean sheet probability is the thing which varies most by fixture, because it kind of behaves in a non-linear way to expected goals.
Yes.
So being able to pick the 3 defenders out of 5 with the best fixture can be a huge advantage without having to make any transfers. So having a structure which allows you to play 3 at the back and being comfortable benching a 5.0 defender now and again can really work to your advantage, which I think can outweigh the kind of basic argument of, well, a Doherty will outscore a, I don't know, generic 6.5 midfielder.
Definitely. Yeah, I'd be inclined to agree. One thing I'm struggling a little bit this year with is, without getting into too much detail, is just like who in defence. You know, even then, the names, I don't feel like there's a plethora of really good options, but it's going to be fun, I think. we should be enthusiastic about the fact that it's hard.
I think it's going to be one of the most fun FPL seasons in history. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
No, that's it. I mean, that's it. I think, you know, it's it's good. Like, one thing that sort of is a bugbear of mine is when you do get a gimme in FPL, people tend to celebrate that. And for me, I tend to dislike that because it closes the... it narrows the window for demonstrating skill, for demonstrating above average manager skill, because that's one less pick that you've got to actually show that you can understand the game better and make better decisions, because everyone gets this gimme, everyone gets Lundstrom, everyone gets Wan-Bissaka. And so it's nice that there aren't many gimmies this year. I mean, Mitrovic is, he's the one, isn't he, this year?
I've not got him, and I'm not.
I do love Mitrovic this year.
Interesting. I've not been that interested, but I think I did trust the Fulham attack. But I think we can get into that when we've got a bit more data.
Yeah, let's see. Cool. If we do another one in a few weeks, then Mitrovic will probably be top scorer by then, and we can revisit this.
No, well, you'll be top of the rankings then. cool. I think we should probably wrap it up there. Unless you got any more topics you want to discuss?
No, I think we should go. I think that's been good. And if anyone's listening, then you know, we've hinted at a lot of other things that we can get into further. But it feels good to me to draw a line there and just to say good luck to everyone. And you know, if you do start getting into modelling and stuff like that, then please do reach out and engage with us. I think there's a bunch of us that are really happy to talk about it. And best of luck for the 2021 season. I think it's going to be a bit of a wild ride.
Just before you go, maybe let the listeners know how they can find you on Twitter.
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is @rogue_we. It was the first social media account I ever had. I'm quite a private person, and I was just lurking on Twitter for a while to find out good information, and eventually I started posting. So I didn't really know how Twitter worked, and I wanted to be called We Rogue, and it gave me this handle, so I just chose that. So it might seem like quite an odd handle to understand, especially for non-English speakers, but that's how you can find me.
Great. I've been Simon.
About you can
find me. You can find me at @analytic_FPL. I didn't know what to choose when I was setting up my non-FPL one and went for Analytic Footy, so it seemed like a easy jump for the FPL handle.
New branch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we'll leave it there. If you like the podcast, I'm not sure how we're going to distribute it yet, but hopefully you can leave it a review or tell your mates, and we'll be back in a month for episode 2. So cheers. Bye.
Sweet. Cheers all.